Yes.
And third, if I see those two out-of-towners again, they'll be going home in a bucket. Is that clear? Got all that?
Yes.
You got a cell phone?
Yes.
Give it to me. The guy dug in a pocket and came back with a phone, black and tiny in his giant red paw. He handed it over, and Reacher pulled it apart. He had seen cell phones dropped on sidewalks, and he knew what was in there, a battery and a SIM card. He pulled off the cover and clipped out the battery and tossed it 20 feet in one direction, and he took out the SIM card and threw the rest of the phone 20 feet in the other direction. He balanced the SIM card on his palm and held it out, a tiny silicon wafer with gold tracks on it. "Eat it," he said. The guy said,
"What?"
"Eat it. That's your forfeit for being a useless tub of lard." The guy paused a second, and then he took it, delicately, finger and thumb, and he opened his mouth and placed it on his tongue. He closed his mouth and worked up some saliva and swallowed. "Show me," Reacher said. The guy opened his mouth again and stuck out his tongue, like a kid at the clinic. The card was gone. "Now sit down."
"What?"
"Like you were before."
"I thought you wanted me to head for the Duncan's place."
"I do," Reacher said, "but not yet. Not while I'm still in the neighborhood." The guy sat down, a little worried, facing south, his legs straight out and his hands on his knees, and his upper body curled forward a little. "Arms behind you," Reacher said. "Lean back on your hands."
"Why?"
"Enemy ordnance." "Just do it," Reacher said. The guy got his arms behind him and put his weight on his hands. Reacher stepped behind him and crashed the sole of his boot through the guy's right elbow. The guy went down flat and shrieked and rolled and whimpered. Then he sat up again and cradled his broken arm and stared at Reacher accusingly. Reacher stepped around behind him again and kicked him hard in the back of the head. The guy toppled slowly, forward at first, and then he twisted sideways as his gut got in the way of further progress. He sprawled out and landed softly on one shoulder and lay still, like a large letter L on a dirty brown page. Reacher turned away and slogged down north toward the two wooden buildings on the horizon. Chapter 22. The Canadian semi-truck with the Duncan's shipment aboard was making good time, heading due east on Route 3 in British Columbia, driving mostly parallel to the Dye Strait International border, with Alberta up ahead. Route 3 was a lonely road, mountainous with steep grades and tight turns, not ideal for a large vehicle. Most drivers took Route 1, which looped north out of Vancouver before turning east later. A better road, all things considered. Route 3 was quiet by comparison. It had long stretches of nothing but asphalt ribbon and wild scenery, and very little traffic, and occasional gravel turnouts for rest and recuperation. One of the gravel turnouts was located a mile or so before Waterton Lakes National Park. In U.S. terms, it was directly above the Washington-Idaho state line, about halfway between Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, about 100 miles north of both. The turnout had an amazing view. Endless forest to the south, the snowy bulk of the Rockies to the east, magnificent lakes to the north. The semi-truck driver pulled off and parked there, but not for the view. He parked there because it was a prearranged location and because a white panel van was waiting there for him. The Duncans had been in business a long time because of luck and caution, and one of their cautionary principles was to transfer their cargo between vehicles as soon as possible after import. Shipping containers could be tracked. Indeed, they were designed to be tracked by the BIC code. Better not to risk a delayed alert from a suspicious customs agent. Better to move the goods within hours into something anonymous and forgettable and untraceable. And white panel vans were the most anonymous and forgettable and untraceable vehicles on Earth. The semi-truck parked, and the panel van K-turned on the gravel and backed up to it and stopped rear to rear with it. Both drivers got out. They didn't speak. They just stepped out into the roadway and craned their necks and checked what was coming. One east, one west. Nothing was coming, which was not unusual for Route 3. So they jogged back to their vehicles and got to work. The van driver opened his rear doors, and the truck driver climbed up on his flatbed and cut the plastic security seal and smacked the bolts and levers out of their brackets and opened the container's doors. 1 minute later, the cargo was transferred, all 1,260 pounds of it. And another minute after that, the white van had K-turned again and was heading east, and the semi-truck was trailing behind it for a spell, its driver intending to turn north on 95 and then loop back west on Route 1, a better road, back to Vancouver for his next job, which was likely to be legitimate, and therefore better for his blood pressure, but worse for his wallet. In Las Vegas, the Lebanese man named Safir selected his two best guys and dispatched them to babysit the Italian man named Rossi. An unwise decision, as it turned out. Its unwisdom was made clear within the hour. Safir's phone rang, and he answered it and found himself talking to an Iranian man named Mahmani. Mahmani was Safir's customer. But there was no transactional equality in their business relationship. Mahmani was Safir's customer in the same way a king might have been a bootmaker's customer. Much more powerful, imperious, superior, dismissive, and likely to be lethally angry if the boots were defective. Or late. Mahmani said, "I should have received my items a week ago." Safir couldn't speak. His mouth was dry. Mahmani said, "Please, look at it from my point of view. Those items are already allocated to certain people in certain places for certain date-specific uses. If they are not delivered in time,